Hi, I'm Zach from Corvallis, Oregon. The Sound of Young America is an independent production supported by listeners like you and me. If you'd like to donate to support the show, visit MaximumFun.org and click on Donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart, and this is The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org. You're listening to The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. My guest on the program is Ann Beatz. She was an original writer on Saturday Night Live. She was an editor at the National Lampoon. She created the cult favorite sitcom Square Pegs and has many other television writing and producing credits. She also teaches the writing of comedy at USC and privately. Ann, welcome to The Sound of Young America.
Thanks so much, Jesse.
So I want to ask you, we might as well go chronologically. I want to ask you about how you came to be involved in the Lampoon.
Well, from dating. I often have said that I got into comedy the same way Catherine the Great got into politics on my back. And I was fixed up on a blind date by a guy named Sean Kelly, who I had worked with in advertising in Montreal, Canada. And I was fixed up on a blind date with Michelle Chiquette, who was a writer and comedian. And he and Sean were working for this new magazine that was in a startup phase in New York, National Lampoon. And so Michelle brought me to New York, and I started sort of helping Michelle with his articles. And then from that, I kind of graduated to actually getting my own byline, which I had to fight. I had actually to fight for. I had to sort of speak up and go, wait, hold on. This is more than helping.
Did you get into it literally because of your relationship with Michelle, or was it something that kind of was that what prompted you to get into writing comedy? Or,
well, in a way, I mean, it wasn't like I said, if I sleep with this guy, then I can get into writing comedy. But I mean, I think what happened is that I was attracted to him, and presumably he to me, because of a mutual sensibility that was comedic. And then I was like, oh, these guys are doing this cool stuff and I want to do it too. And that was kind of really the only way that women did get into comedy at that point.
Did you have aspirations to be involved in comedy before that?
I think I had aspirations to be funny, but I think that, you know, I've said this in other interviews also, that comedy is not, at that time, comedy was not really a career choice. It was not a career choice. It was something that people kind of who couldn't get any other jobs did. If you couldn't get up in the morning and you basically were unemployable, you could go into comedy. So, you know, it was not something that was being taught at expensive universities as it is today by people like myself. So, you know, it was kind of like, oh, they're starting this magazine and how interesting. And, you know, I want to be connected to and a part of this. And I can remember several sort of epiphany moments connected with that. And I mean, I do owe a debt of gratitude to Michelle, because he would bring me, they would have these dinner meetings at very bad restaurants like Steak and Brew and so on, terrible Indian
Sounds
restaurants.
Sounds like a nice place, Steak and Brew.
Where they served cat, you know. I mean, it was the lowest restaurants in New York. It would be these editorial meetings where dinner was paid for, right? And the guys, and they would kind of drink a lot of beer. And then they would talk about the issue that they were currently working on. And all the issues of the Lampoon at that time had themes. So, you know, it would be around a certain theme. And, like, I once worked on the boredom issue. and so, you know, politics or whatever it would be. And people would jot down ideas on napkins and so on. And later on, they would go like, well, whose idea was that? And, you know, it would turn out to have been my idea. And then they were kind of stuck. you know, Michelle just brought me to those dinners. And I remember one time in a Chinese restaurant that Doug Kenny, who was one of the original founders of the magazine, along with Henry Beard, and I remember Doug, you know, getting up from the table to call his wife, you know, and it was one of those like, honey, well, I'll be home, you know, I'll be home at 9. Well, no, I'll be home at 10. Well, maybe I'll be home at 11 kind of things. And I thought, you know what? I never want to be on the other end of that phone. I never want to be on the other end of the phone. I want to be here.
Dude, what was it? What got you the byline ultimately?
I fought for it. I went like, hey, hey, I wrote this with you. And so Michelle did, you know, move over and let me share a byline. And then I started coming up with stuff on my own and getting things of my own into the magazine. And
do you remember what the first thing that you got in that was your own
work? That was entirely my own byline. I know there was one piece that I did that kind of was well received, which was this whole thing about Native Americans. And it was sort of trying to prove that Native Americans, you know, were more advanced and noble. And, but in a kind of disparaging way. I mean, like my theory was that the Native Americans did have the wheel. They just hadn't figured out what to do with it. And so it showed like some illustrations where like someone was wearing a wheel around their neck, you know, as a collar and different things, but they just hadn't figured out that you had to put it on something and pull things. So, and I remember getting a letter from someone at the Smithsonian saying, you know, how brilliant and, you know, I must have studied the Indians for years or whatever to be able to write this. But then it, you know, was like praise for their poetry and music. And I remember that one of the songs that I cited, of course, as being, you know, it was supposed to be a literary learned treatise. And one of the songs that I cited was, the poetry of this song. And it was, I'm going to meet my grandmother. And the chorus was, go ahead, go ahead. So anyway, you have to remember that the National Lampoon in that non-PC era was really, you know, it was an equal opportunity offender. It attacked everyone.
It was very well known at the time for being very aggressive and sort of borderline mean, wasn't it?
Well, mean, I would say it was, you know, satire is mean. I mean, is Jonathan Swift A Modest Proposal? Is that mean? You know, would you call that mean? I would say it's sharp. And, you know, I think that my next boyfriend, Michael O'Donoghue, was really the master at that kind of thing. And one of the things that I really admired, a brilliant piece that he did was called the Vietnamese Baby Book, which featured things like Baby's First Wound, a book that could well be revived today with a slightly different slant.
One of the interesting things to me about the kind of the history of the Lampoon was that it came out in this time when like the comedic precedent in the United States was mostly like Laugh-In or something like that.
Well, yeah. I mean, although Laugh-In could be pretty, I mean, don't forget the Smothers Brothers were taken off the air, you know, for being too political. I mean, Laugh-In could get its digs in too, so I wouldn't run down Laugh-In, but I would say, yes, there hadn't been, I mean, Mad Magazine was of a different sensibility and a different generational appeal, I think. And Mad Magazine, and interestingly enough, a lot of the people that wrote for the Lampoon had sort of grown up on Mad Magazine. But, you know, the big difference was that with National Lampoon, you would do the piece very, very close to the bone, close to the way the original would be, which is really one of the things about parody. And in Mad Magazine, you know, the character would have flies buzzing around their head. You know, it was much more cartoony.
Were there things that you saw as, and when I say you, I mean sort of both you personally and a collective you, as some kind of precedent for what you were doing on the Lampoon?
We were admirers of the British magazine Private Eye. And in fact, there was Pat Nixon's diary, I think, or who was it? Yes. I think there was Mrs. Nixon's diary was in the National Lampoon. And that was a total rip on, Mrs. Wilson's diary, which was in Private Eye. So, I mean, it was kind of that was clearly an influence. I would say that, the Pythons were an influence. Certainly Mad. I mean, interesting, there was a sort of nexus where Mad Magazine and the Lampoon came together, which was in the Lieutenant Cali cover of the Lampoon, which showed him as, you know, the famous Mad character. He was saying, instead of saying, "What me worry," he was saying, "What me lie." And so that was kind of where those two things went together and got plugged into each other.
You have to admit, that is a step past the Smothers Brothers, you know, booking lefty folk singers on their show and getting in trouble for that.
It is. And in fact, as a result of the Vietnamese Baby book, Michael O'Donoghue got hate mail from GIs who threatened him with physical violence. Because they kind of, didn't get it, I think. I mean, so there was Lampoon. I mean, Henry Beard used to reject people for the Lampoon very kindly by saying that they were too far out for the National Lampoon. And people would be very pleased. You know, they'd go away going, "Wow, I'm too far out." That was his method of rejection. "Wow, I'm too far out for the Lampoon. I must be really far out." But yeah, Lampoon tried to stay pretty close to the edge.
The Lampoon was something that changed really fast in terms of its cultural impact. Like, it went from kind of like a very shaky operation into this big national thing.
The big key to that was cigarette advertising was kicked off of television. So when people used to ask me after I worked on the Lampoon, which was perceived as sort of quasi-underground, although it was published out of the same offices on Madison Avenue that published, you know, Weight Watchers magazine. So it really wasn't too underground.
In fact, I think that was the company's big success before the National Lampoon.
Yes, it was. In fact, you know, people would say, "Well, now you're on television." When I was working on SNL, and they would be like, "And, you know, you sold out to television." I would like, "Hey, I got my career start out of giving cancer to college students. Don't tell me about selling out." Because basically what happened is that a guy named Jerry Taylor, who happened to be married to Mary Travers of Peter, Paul, and Mary, came along and started to sell cigarette advertising in the Lampoon because it was a way of reaching kids. And that was it. That was what kept the Lampoon going for that period and bridged the gap for them to become a pretty successful publication.
This is The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Ann Beats, was the first female editor of the National Lampoon. When we come back from a short break, we'll talk about her career writing for Saturday Night Live. Hey, it's me, Jesse. I hope you're enjoying our interview with Ann Beats, original writer for Saturday Night Live, creator of the cult television series Square Pegs, and the first female editor of the National Lampoon. I think it's a really great example of what we do here at The Sound of Young America. A fun, in-depth interview with somebody who's really made a difference in the history of American pop culture. Anyway, if you're listening to this show, you're probably subscribed to the podcast. And if you're subscribed to the podcast, you probably enjoy it. And no matter how you get the show, you get it for free. So listen. The reason I can afford to give away, or at least kind of afford to give away all this work for free, is because of direct support from listeners like you. That's why from May 1st through 15th of this year, we're having our first ever MaximumFun.org pledge drive. Now, I know what you're thinking, a pledge drive, how cliche. I can promise there will be no tote bags in this pledge drive, and I will not be podcasting any Suze Orman specials or reruns of The Three Tenors or Les Miserables in concert. But I am asking you to support this work that we do at MaximumFun.org. Visit our website and click on Donate. You can choose to give anything from $2 a month to $20 a month, or you can just make a one-time donation if you'd like. I usually ask for the former because it keeps me out of your hair. I don't have to keep coming back to you for money. You don't have to do it out of a pure-hearted sense of charity, though. There are presents to be had. If you give at the $10 or $20 a month level, you'll get a free Sound of Young America t-shirt mailed right to your door. Can't beat that with a bat. Not only that, but everyone who donates will get a Maximum Fun Club kit, which includes a membership card inscribed by yours truly, stickers, and a pin. And it's a great way to meet other people who like the Sound of Young America. You just hold out the card, and if they recognize it, well, they also like the Sound of Young America, and they're worth talking to. And if they don't, they might be weirded out, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, everyone who donates will also be entered into our big prize drawing. You can win an autographed copy of Casper Hauser's Sky Mall, John Hodgman's The Area of My Expertise, also autographed by the author, or even a complete DVD box set of Get Smart, one of television's most classicist sitcoms. And that box set sells for something like $300 in the stores. Visit MaximumFun.org and click on Donate today. I know you care about the Sound of Young America, and I really appreciate your support. We now return to my interview with comedy writer Ann Beats. How did you end up with Michael O'Donohue? I know that was part of how you ended up at Saturday Night Live.
Well, yeah, I sort of switched boyfriends in mid-magazine. And then Michael and I were together for a while at the Lampoon, and Michael started doing the National Lampoon Radio Hour, and which I also worked on. I worked in radio. I worked in mini media, multimedia. Which was very fun because I'm sure, as you know from radio, you know, it's wonderfully intimate and you can also create all sorts of, you know, fantasies in people's minds on the radio. And, you know, you can blow up New York, whatever you feel like doing. Then Michael had a big run-in with Maddie Simmons and left, and I left with him.
Maddie Simmons being the publisher
and the original publisher of Weight Watchers. The genesis of Lampoon had been that Henry Beard and Doug Kenny, who were at the Harvard Lampoon, did a parody of Life magazine that was pretty successful because the Harvard Lampoon used to publish one special parody a year, and they did I think it was Mademoiselle magazine, and they did, or a woman's magazine anyway, and then they did a Life magazine parody where they had the globe as like a cracked egg on the cover of Life. And then they had done a book called Board of the Rings, which was a parody of Lord of the Rings. I always wondered why, when the Ring movies came out, no one revived that book. I thought it would have been great. They should have dragged it out and dusted it off. So they then got the idea that they could do a magazine, and they and a guy named Rob Hoffman, who was, I think, a law student, these three Harvard guys came to Maddie Simmons, and who had been the publisher of these two other endeavors or three other endeavors, and said, you know, how about a magazine? That's how it got started. So Michael O'Donohue had a falling out with Maddie, and in which I was involved, and on Easter Sunday, as a matter of fact, and we were off anything to do with the Lampoon, and had sort of a struggling year. And then Lorne Michaels entered our life. Two things. One, I sold a book actually called Titters, the first collection of humor by women, to Macmillan, and started working on that. And then also Lorne Michaels came along and offered Michael and then me a job on his new television show. And I turned the job down.
Wait, so how or what were the circumstances of him offering the two of you?
Well, I think he liked gigs. The idea of having couples, you know, like, because perhaps he suspected that the show would be as it was, something like Noah's Ark, and that he needed to have two by two.
And his wife was a writer on the show.
Rosie Schuster,
and
yeah.
Was your writing partner.
His estranged wife.
Ah, okay.
Yes. So what happened was that a woman named Marilyn Suzanne Miller, who had known Lorne Michaels from working on the Lily Tomlin specials, which he had written and produced, and she was a writer on them, was a big fan of Michael's and told Lorne about Michael. And so when Lorne came to New York, he looked Michael up, and we had him over to dinner, and then he offered us both jobs.
I read in I remember reading in one of the Saturday Night Live books that in that first dinner meeting, one of the first things that you told Lorne Michaels was that you didn't like the Lily Tomlin shows. Is that true?
Well, that is true that I told him I didn't like the Lily Tomlin shows, but it was not in the dinner meeting. It was when I went up to the office to meet with him specifically to talk about my being hired on the show. And it was the first and only time I think I ever kept Lorne waiting because I was getting a perm. And it didn't take, and they had to redo it. And so I kept calling Lorne's office and going, well, I'll be there in an hour, and I'll be there in another hour, and so on. And so I actually was late to meet Lorne. And then, you know, the shoe was permanently on the other foot for the rest of the time that I had anything to do with him. But when I finally did show up there, first of all, there was this very twitchy, weird guy waiting in the office with me. And I was like, oh, this is the kind of person that he's hiring? Yeah, I don't know if I want to do this. And it was Andy Kaufman. And then when I went in to talk to Lorne, I told Lorne that I was not a fan of the Lily Tomlin specials, that I actually liked the Sonny and Cher show better.
That's a really nice thing to say to someone who fancies himself some sort of fashioning a countercultural movement.
I don't know why he hired me. I mean, I was just so awful. I can't imagine why he wanted to hire me. But, I mean, I don't know. He did. He offered me the job. And then when I turned it down, he talked me into taking it. So I guess he wanted to hire me. Something. He must have liked something.
What kind of thing was he pitching it to you as, and how did you imagine it might actually be?
I really didn't know. I mean, I don't think he knew. So, I mean, I don't know. It was quite amorphous. I mean, I remember saying to him, I was so negative. I remember saying to him, I didn't like the name. This was later when he was like, he had already hired me, I think. And I was like, why is it called Saturday Night? That's a silly name. And he said, so that it was a great answer. He said, so the network can remember when it's on, which was true. It was great because they could hardly shift it to a different night. I mean, I suppose they could have, but it would have been a little embarrassing to move a show called Saturday Night to, say, Friday Night.
What was it like to figure out what kind of show it would be? Like, between the time that you got hired and the time that it actually was on television, what was that like?
Well, you know, I should mention someone else in this mix, which is Dick Ebersol, who was the NBC executive who Lorne had sort of interfaced with. I mean, you know, if I always think of, like, you know, Lorne was the electrical cord and Dick Ebersol was the plug. And Lorne plugged in to Dick Ebersol. Okay. And, you know, and it was sort of a period of time, you know, this was 1975. People were going, gosh, what are the kids into? You know, it was post Watergate. It was all of this stuff. And so it was kind of like, we don't know what young people like, but they might like this. And what this wasn't clear. And that was the brilliance. I mean, the fact that it was a live show, because if we had to make a taped pilot, a la Andy Kaufman or Richard Pryor, any of these people, and, well, Richard Pryor did get a number of shows on the air, but I mean, if we had to just make a taped pilot of Saturday Night Live and have it, you know, focus grouped and tested and shown to different executives, it would never have been a show. Never. It was because it was live. So it could evolve. And also, Lorne was able, and I guess Dick was able to get for him the ability to have a really long pre-production period. So first of all, the writers were hired first, another unheard of thing. Writers were hired. There was no cast, just the writers. And we all kind of hung out together and came up with stuff. And it was a long period from, it was right after July 4th in 1975. And the first show wasn't until October 12th, I think, 75. So that was a really long period of pre-production where we were on staff and had offices and were in the RCA building, you know, running around.
What kind of stuff were you coming up with at that point?
Well, things that made us laugh, which I think was the key. stuff that we would like to see on television. And I mean, that was the key to it. And the key to idea of it was that there was no they. We, you know, it's like Pogo. We have met the enemy and they is us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that we weren't going like, ooh, what would they like to see? You know, like I once heard an executive in a meeting saying it doesn't reach the people we fly over. You know, the thing was that we weren't doing it for others. We were doing it for ourselves. And that was unique, I think, in television at that point. So I wasn't trying to second guess the audience or please people. It was like, do we think it's funny?
What was something that you thought of as an idea for the show that ended up making it, that you thought of before the show was actually?
The speed commercial that I recorded myself. And I wrote that. That was one of the first pieces that I wrote. And at that time, I had never done any speed. But people were always, I was very, you know, hyper, high energy personality, type A personality. And people would go, are you on speed? You know, and it was my natural speed. So I just thought, okay, I'm going to harness that. And there was a commercial on TV at the time, which was like for Tang, where it was the mother was like, hi, I'm a da-da. So, you know, I did this thing where it was like, hi, I'm Ellen Sherman, housewife and mother, and I'm commissioner of consumer affairs, but I'm also designing a shopping center, and just went on and on.
Meet Ellen Sherman, Cleveland housewife and mother.
Hi, I'm a nuclear physicist and commissioner of consumer affairs. In my spare time, I do needlepoint, read, sculpt, take riding lessons, and brush up on my knowledge of current events. Thursday's my day at the daycare center, and then there's my work with the deaf. But I still have time left over to do all my own baking and practice my backhand, even though I'm on call 24 hours a day as a legal agent.
All these things, and then it went, and I take speed.
How does Ellen Sherman do it all? She's smart. She takes speed. Yes, speed. The tiny blue diet pill you don't have to be overweight to need.
And then I collect these paper bags. And I have them right here, all folded and everything. In case anyone needs a paper bag, I have one. Because I fold them neatly, you know. I don't fold them just any old way.
Why not ask your family doctor for a prescription today? And when that runs out, you can ask your neighbor's doctor. And your mother's doctor. And your college roommate's doctor. And your best friend from high school, doctor. And your babysitter.
And I wrote that, and it was actually used as the audition piece for the female cast for the show. And I remember Jane Curtin really nailed it. And then I was producing the parody commercials for the show, and Lorne was sort of wanted to have the cast members do it. And as later they did, and it was much more of a better idea to have them do it, but... Michael was on my side, and Michael and I had this idea that it was, they wouldn't seem, you know, we wanted people to think they were real commercials, and if the cast was in it, then they wouldn't. And so initially, the commercial parodies didn't feature the cast members, and Michael and Chevy were in some of the commercials, but they were writers, so they weren't cast members. So that's why they did some commercials, because Chevy Chase had not yet been cast in the show. He was hired as a writer, as was Garrett Morris. And so the idea was that there would be no laughs during the commercials and it would seem like a real commercial. So I got to do the speed commercial myself. And it was the first thing that was ever shot in Studio 8H under the auspices of Saturday Night Live. The studio got fired up and that was the first piece that we started with. And I had to do 27 takes because equipment problems... And also the damn paper bags that I was collecting, the paper bags rattled tremendously. So there was like all this paper bag noise and before lunch. It was pretty
Everyone
hairy.
Knows that the downfall of a commercial parody is going to be paper bag noise.
Yes.
That's
yes.
A good rule of thumb.
Yes. Well, you see, I had worked in advertising. I was a copywriter and I had actually produced actual television commercials. So I kind of knew a little bit about it. Not a whole bunch, but I knew a little bit about it.
Not enough to cut the paper bags out of the sketch.
No, but the paper bags were integral to the sketch. And it worked in the end, I think.
Were there ideas that you had early on, or can you give me an example of an idea that you had early on that really didn't work, that you expected to be something that would, you know, make an impact and didn't?
I don't know if it worked or didn't work. I mean, the funny thing about, you know, writing on SNL for 5 years is that there are things I forget that I wrote. and I'll be watching television, I'll see something and I'll go, oh, that, right, yeah. Oh, Rosie and I wrote that. because Rosie Schuster and I worked as writing partners.
And let the record show. Let the record show that your face while saying those words was none too pleased.
No. Well, I would be like, oh, killer trees. That was not a success. And then somebody will somewhere say, you know, killer trees, the most brilliant sketch ever. And I adored it. So, you know, there's no accounting for taste. I mean, Reagan actually referenced killer trees at one point. He looked down and went, was flying in somewhere, and he said, oh, killer trees.
You must have been very proud.
I was. And nerd got into the dictionary also, I think, partly as a result of Rosie Schuster and my efforts. And now it's a candy that my daughter likes to eat.
It's a good candy, too. It's a very good candy. I like that candy.
Okay.
I don't know what that says about you, but... One of the weird things about the very beginning of Saturday Night Live to me is that it started out as such a nothing and then became such a phenomenon so weirdly fast. And I wonder what it was like to be inside of that, where at the beginning it was this very odd experiment, and then at the end of the year it was on magazine covers and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, we didn't kind of totally get it. I mean, and no one did. I mean, we were also in New York, you know, where there's not that sort of fandom is not – you're not exposed to that. And people are very cool in New York. You know, they don't, like, run up to you as much. And so we kind of didn't know what the extent of it was. And people that I knew, you know, our friends would keep going like, well, it's canceled, right? And we go, no, actually, it's kind of successful. But people kept thinking that it would be canceled, you know, because it had to be, because it was too hip for TV and had to be canceled. And I think when we really kind of got it, I mean, I remember that the cast had some appearance at a shopping mall or something, and they were like mobbed. And then we really got it when we went to New Orleans, and they had to reroute the Mardi Gras parade because there were so many people that wanted to be on Saturday Night Live and be in front of the reviewing stand that Buck, Henry, and Jane Curtin were at, that they had to reroute the parade because they couldn't get it through. So that at that point, I mean, and people, you know, some guy jumped Gilda and tried to – I mean, she had to wear a mask to go from her hotel to the set. Some guy tried to stick his head under her skirt when she was actually wardrobed and made up as Emily Latella, so – which is pretty weird. But
it was distinctly weird.
Yeah. So, you know, at that point, we kind of went, oh, you know, oh.
Did it change things behind the scenes?
Well, Chevy's emergence, Chevy was kind of like a stalking horse for the show in a way. I mean, in that he was the most middle American, attractive looking, you know, good looking guy. Something always a little funny about his upper lip, but he was a good looking, tall American WASP guy. You know, he wasn't one of what Kurt Vonnegut referred to as the funny looking people. He wasn't ethnic. And so, you know, people were talking about him as being the next Carson and all this kind of nonsense. And so I think that was a big attention getter for the show, and it definitely changed the behind the scenes dynamic, and it ultimately caused Chevy to leave.
One of the stories about Chevy Chase that you hear is kind of a transformation over that period of time in the way that he related to the other people on the show. Did you experience that?
Well, I mean, I think it would be inevitable for anyone to experience that when they suddenly got that kind of heat. And I know that Chevy came back in the fall, and Lorne was doing his utmost to try and persuade him to stay. And so Lorne was kind of putting Chevy in all the parody commercials, like, let Chevy do it. You know, Chevy can play this, you know, sort of because he wanted to keep him. And partially Chevy did get the movie Foul Play with Goldie Hawn, but I mean, he also had a girlfriend who he then married who was out on the West Coast, and Jackie, and he wanted to go and be with her. So that was, it was also partly a personal decision. So, I mean, I think it was inevitable, but, you know, I think people's characters were pretty hardened before anything happened to them in terms of success spoiling them. I think that it was a bunch of people who always had giant egos, even when they were living on food stamps. So I don't buy into the theory of, oh, and then people got successful and then drugs and You know, I just think, you know, this was a really tough bunch of egos to cage in one place.
There was all these sort of odd personal relationships going on in between the different players in the world of Saturday Night Live. I mean, above and beyond you going out with you being with Michael O'Donohue and Lorne Michaels' estranged wife being a writer on the show. Do you think that was beneficial, that kind of close, those kind of close and tempestuous relationships, or do you think that it was harmful?
I think it was inevitable because it was just like Noah's Ark. You couldn't date outside of the Ark. You were stuck. I mean, I once tried to go out with somebody, this guy named Hamilton Fish. I think it was Hamilton Fish III or something. Came from an illustrious New York family.
He sounds like a good guy.
He was a writer, and I see his byline different places. And I was supposed to meet him at the Russian Tea Room at one period where it was like between boyfriends.
You were supposed
period.
To meet him at the Russian Tea Room for a parody of a New York date.
Right. Well, people went to the Russian Tea Room in those days. And I for dinner, and I kept calling him and going like, "You go ahead and order a drink, and why don't you order an appetizer, and then why don't you just have dinner, and then I'll be there, you know." And so it's like you couldn't extract yourself. So who were you going to have a relationship with? We're there, you know, 24/7.
What led to you leaving Saturday Night Live? You spent 5 years at Saturday Night Live.
Well, everyone
won two
left.
Emmys.
Everyone left at the same time because Lorne left. That was what led to it. It was very simple. We were burnt out anyway. I mean, 5 years of it. Although some people have done it for 9 and 10 years. I don't know how they do, but it's a different world there now. We were really burnt out.
You weren't excited to work with Charles Rocket?
Or? It wasn't even an issue. What happened was Lorne Michaels wanted the network to give us a hiatus until January. And then we would come back with a slightly redesigned show. We would go down for retooling and refitting like a submarine. And we would come back up. Surface with a slightly different format to be determined. And
I would think that submarines, I don't mean to prick the bubble of your metaphor here, but do you think they really do their repairs underwater?
Oh, perhaps not. They probably pull them out. Anyway, whatever.
Seems inconvenient to me. That's all I'm
but
saying.
But I'm just saying, I know they put them in into dry dock.
Right, okay.
All right. So we would go into dry dock. Let me revise my metaphor here. We would go into dry dock for a while, and then we would be reactivated to active duty. And that was what he wanted to do. And, because once I said that the show was a combination of summer camp and concentration camp. And Mike Myers said it was a combination of Showboat and Das Boot. Which was about a submarine. That's why submarines were in my head. And the network didn't want to do that because they didn't want to, like, kill this cash cow, right? I mean, so they wanted the show to just keep going. I mean, they originally wanted us to do it year-round. We'd only have 2 weeks off. Johnny only takes 2 weeks off. Why do you need more? You know, we're supposed to do it in the summer and Christmas and everything. And that got stopped after the first year, thank God. And so they offered the job to Lorne's supposed second in command, who was really the person who booked the talent. I mean, that was what she didn't physically do the, like, okay, your agent will be da-da. But she was the person who was in charge of the hosts. You know, getting the hosts, hand-holding the hosts, whatever. Jean Dominion. And they looked on the thing, and she was the vice president, whatever she was, you know, not vice president. She was the associate producer. They said, okay, we'll give the job to Jean. And she took it. For which she will be forever damned in hell and eternity for having, no, but I mean, it was kind of sleazy. It was a little bit of a sleazy move because we had given her grade.
Right.
And, you know, but she bought an awful lot of Armani outfits with with her paychecks. And you know, Carrie Shearer said about Gina Meany, said she's always dressed for Halston's funeral. She used to wear black all the time. And her shoes were never scuffed. I didn't know how she did that, but she would wear these heels. Maybe she wore running shoes and brought them to work in a bag, but she always had these immaculate high heels. You know, she just said, okay, I'll do it. So Lorne said, well, bye. And she did. She offered me a job. And she offered me a job. And I said no. And everyone said no. And that was it.
This is The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Ann Beats, was an original writer on Saturday Night Live. These days, Ann teaches comedy courses. We'll find out a little bit about what she teaches when we return in just a moment. The Sound of Young America is supported in part by Project Breakout, an online comedy competition now in its final round at projectbreakout.com. Hey, it's Jesse. I won't give you the spiel again, but I will reiterate that The Sound of Young America is supported by direct donations from listeners just like you, people who love The Sound of Young America and want to support it. If you're one of those people, visit MaximumFun.org and click on Donate. When you donate, you'll enter into our cool prize drawing and you'll get a prize in the mail besides. That's MaximumFun.org, then click on Donate. We now return to The Sound of Young America and comedy writer Ann Beats. I want to ask you about something that I'm sure you've spent plenty of time talking about, which is the role of women on the Saturday Night Live in the beginning. I read again in one of those Saturday Night Live history books, there's been a couple and they kind of run together in my head, that there was at one point in the first season, quite literally like a meeting, like a,
yeah,
like
I think
a union
that's in
organizing
the
meeting.
The Weingrad Hill book, that's in that. And they kind of get it wrong.
Well, tell us what happened.
But no, well, I decided that we needed to, band together. And I had a slumber party for girls, a pajama party in my apartment, for which men were, no boys allowed. And we talked about all of this stuff. And I think, I was just kind of like leading a charge and there was no one behind me.
But was there no one behind you because there was no problem or because people were scared or something else?
There was a definite problem. I mean, there was an absolute problem. But perhaps, confronting it head on wasn't necessarily the best way.
That's not always the best solution to everything.
No, it wasn't maybe the best solution, but there was definitely a problem, although there was a much worse problem later.
Tell me about
much worse.
At the time, what was the problem? What was going on?
Well, I mean, women were not, for example, at the Lampoon, where, at least at Saturday Night Live, I was getting paid. and they originally, they actually started to pay me and Michael the same. And then they said, oh, we made a mistake and you're not supposed to be getting the same amount as Michael. And I was like, what? And I went to Lorne and said, hey, I'm not giving the money back and you need to give me a raise. And he did. He said, just pay them the same. So, which is amazing. I mean, amazing that he did that. But so I guess he must have liked me. I don't know, or something. But anyway, there was definitely this sort of attitude at the Lampoon where Doug Kenny said to me, I just don't think chicks are funny.
Which is a pretty bold thing to say to one of your writers you hired to be funny.
Right. I just don't think chicks are funny. So, it was always like you had to always keep proving yourself. You had to be like, funny, 10% funnier. It's like being a voter in the South. You had to spell anti as disestablishmentarianism, and everyone else had to spell cat. You had to just work harder and stay up later and do all of this stuff more to prove yourself. I met Bruce J. Friedman, who later became a friend, the humorist and writer, fabulous writer, Bruce J. Friedman, and one of the black, not literally black, but black quote unquote humorists of the 60s and 70s. And he said, well, you're a writer on the show. You must be Marilyn Suzanne Miller. And I said, no, I'm Ann Beats. And he said, really? Well, what about, I said, well, you know, she's also a writer. And he said, really? I didn't know they had so many. Two.
A pair, a matching pair.
And Rosie Schuster, of course, was also on the show at the time. Three was the most they ever had under.
How did it get?
Period.
You said it wasn't as bad then as it later got. How did it get worse?
Well, I think when Lorne had delegated the running of the show more to some other people, such as Jim Downey, and there were people in the cast of the show like Chris Farley and so on. I mean, I don't want to speak ill of the dead, but I think there were tremendously sexist attitudes that were manifesting themselves at that point in time, and also, you know, under the Dick Ebersol years, I mean, Julia Louis-Dreyfus wasn't exactly a happy camper, and any of those gals. I went back and worked on the show 1 week, and I don't think they were, you know, getting their just desserts. And if you feel persecuted and uncomfortable, it's hard to do your best work. It's hard to be fun.
Let me ask you about your current career, which is teaching comedy and teaching comedy writing. How did you get into that business?
Well, I got asked to go to Toronto and be part of a week-long comedy sort of seminar that they were having at this college outside of Toronto. And I said yes, and then I kind of forgot about it. And then I realized, oh, I have to go to Toronto tomorrow. And I thought, what am I going to do? And I thought, well, I'll just do SNL. That's what I know, so, you know, that's what I'll do. And so I taught this class where I got people to write sketches and rewrite them, and we put it on, but we put on a show. And now at that college, Humber College, they have the traditional show. But at the time, it was kind of like, oh, what? You want to put on a show? And I was like, well, you know, they wrote this stuff. How do they know if it works if they don't perform it in front of anyone? And so I started working with them, and I did that for a number of years, summers. I would go there and do it. And then I actually taught there at one point in the wintertime, in November in Toronto. And then I thought, you know, could I do this closer to home, perhaps? I'd also done it in Manhattan. And I decided to put up my own course. And initially I was working with the Improv Olympic, and then I thought that I should try just doing it on my own. And so now I have a comedy class where I teach comedy sketch writing and performing in 3-hour classes spread across a 5-week period. And then we have a rehearsal period, and we put a sketch show up.
Let me ask you this, though. I think there's probably a lot of people who think, oh, you're just funny or not funny. What are the things that you can teach someone about how to write comedy?
Well, I mean, you can teach them structure. You can take their ideas and help to shape them. You know, you can say that will work better as a commercial parody, or that idea might work better as, rather than a full out written through sketch, you know, maybe why don't you try writing it as though it's a promo or it's a movie and it's a movie trailer. You can teach them how to do parody. I mean, you can definitely, I mean, okay, if you have somebody who has no, if there is that person on the planet even that has no zero sense of humor at all, it'd be hard perhaps to teach them, but you can take people's natural comedic bent and you can help them to learn how to execute material that will make other people laugh. And I can only attest to the fact that I've done it now in Los Angeles 15 times. So
do what age are the students that you're teaching for the most part?
I think they're for all ages and all walks of life, interestingly enough. And I always ask them what their day jobs are, and the most unusual job I ever had was someone whose day job was going around in a van giving high colonics to very privileged dogs.
Wait, dogs?
Dogs. He gave high colonics to dogs.
And you said, I live in Hollywood.
Yes, right. And some people have just way too much money and not enough sense.
Oh, my God. I can't even believe that's real.
It is.
That's like something that you would read about in the Lampoon. That's not
yes,
like something
I know.
That would
it's
happen
not
in
like
real
a real
life.
Job, but this, but that was the guy's job. But you know, I mean, of course, I have a lot of people who are either involved in sketch or stand up in the comedy scene in Los Angeles, which is very lively and active at this point in time. You know, sometimes, I mean, people always say, you know, will people in the class be of my caliber, or, you know, what are the criteria for being in? Well, you know, sometimes people who have not done it before can turn out to be the funniest people. I mean, because they kind of aren't jaded, and so they can come up with great stuff. So I never really know going into the class who's going to turn out to be the shining star.
How do the subject matters and the styles that people write in your classes compare to the kind of sketch that you were writing in those early years of Saturday Night Live 30 years ago?
Well, I would say that they tend to be perhaps more pop culture oriented, and that sadly, I would like to see more political material, because I feel like it's so there's so much fuel for that out there in what's going on in the country. And I would like to see more of that. But there often isn't. But there's a lot of, you know, maybe Britney Spears jokes or whatever. You know, I think more pop culture, which has become, you know, our culture. You know, there is a limitation in that we're doing this as a sketch show on stage. So, I mean, I sort of have to convince people that they cannot write car chases or, you know, close-ups of flowers or that kind of thing that, you know, we're on stage. This is not going to work. But, you know, or that if they write something that has, you know, a giant chicken outfit in it, that they better be prepared to either build, borrow, rent, or steal the giant chicken outfit. Because we don't have the NBC studio resources at our hand to get a giant chicken created for us. Other than that, it's pretty much anything goes. And I always think it's interesting. And I mean, just in terms of, you know, you might go, oh, student show, da-da-da. But I mean, three of my students have been in the final 10 at different times, have been in the final 10 for potentially being hired on SNL. As performers. Not one of them got hired, but they were brought to New York and all of that stuff.
I mean, so. That's pretty good still.
Yeah, it's still pretty good.
Do you have any, like, pet theories that you teach?
Pet theories.
Do you have any maxims that you can share with our with our audience?
Well, I mean, I do think you have to think about, do you think it's funny? I mean, I think you have to please yourself. But I mean, on the other hand, if no one is laughing, then it's hard to make a case, you know, that it's funny. I mean, there should at least be one person out there laughing. And I also think that, you know, I try to steer people away from doing just, you know, I mean, I always say, like, okay, sure, you can get up on stage, drop your pants, people will probably laugh. But, you know, will they keep, you know, how many times can you do it? And do you really want to be known as
the pants dropper,
the pants dropping guy, you know? So let's try and aim a little higher. Let's try and aim a little higher than
the
that.
Shirt dropping guy.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. The shirt dropping guy. Because I just think that, you know, trying to be, I mean, I think you there's something about, it was a guy who wrote a book about Second City, and it was called Something Wonderful Right Away. And that's what Del Close used to say that he wanted. And I mean, I think when you, it's one of those things that you, when you see it, you know it. And you go, yes, that's right. Okay, we'll keep that.
Is there something to having the discipline to generate enough that there are things coming out, and then when you see it, you know it?
Yeah, well, I mean, all writing is rewriting, isn't it? And I mean, and you can't be a perfection. I mean, perfectionism is a terrible trap. I mean, you have to just kind of do it. I mean, you have to just have the, and that was a great thing about Al Franken, is that he would just like barrel on through, you know, like, this is great, you know, and maybe it wasn't so great. But I mean, if he kept pushing it, ultimately, you know, it'd get somewhere. So I think that you have to have a certain kind of, I mean, it's strange. I was just talking about this with a friend of mine, or a writer friend of mine, and saying, you know, in order to succeed in Hollywood, you have to have this kind of, you know, to be a creative person, you have to be incredibly sensitive, and you have to sort of be like this little sea anemone that takes in all of this stuff. And I don't know, I'm underwater again. I'm sorry. I'm a Pisces. I guess I go there. But anyway, you just have to kind of take in all of these impressions and so on and be open to the universe. And then you also have to be like a hermit crab, because you have to have this like hard shell that will just protect you from everyone trying to change your stuff and, you know, protect your vision. So it's difficult to balance those two qualities. And I think the people that are most successful are the people that have the ability to do that, balance those two things.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for being on The Sound of Young America.
Well, thank you, Jesse. It's been fun.
Anne Beetz is a professor of screenwriting at the University of Southern California. She also teaches sketch comedy writing privately. Her next round of classes begins in Southern California, May 14th. For more information, visit myspace.com/AnnBeetz. That's spelled AnnEBeatts. In the interest of full disclosure, I'm working with Anne on a project for The Sound of Young America's underwriter Project Breakout, but I booked and conducted this interview before she got involved with the project. Well, that's our time for an extra long edition of The Sound of Young America. I've been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our theme music was written and performed by Dan Grayson with some help from myself, and our interstitial music is contributed by Dan Wally. You can find us on the internet at MaximumFun.org, where you can participate in our forums, check out our blog, or donate for the Sound of Young America MaximumFun.org pledge drive, May 1st through May 15th. We'll see you later this week on The Sound of Young America.